Last January, residents of Milford, Massachusetts, packed together in a meeting room beneath the local town hall. In attendance were representatives of Amazon, the company that had made life a lot more difficult for Milford residents over the past few years. Amazon had opened a special kind of delivery warehouse in the town, and it was driving people crazy.
My name is David Bliss. My wife and I have lived here for 20 years on two different sides of town, so we know what reality is. We have traffic on Dilla Street, we have traffic on Main Street, we have rush hour, like any other town. You live with that, you learn a little with that. But when Amazon came to town, the entire dynamic changed, and it got worse and worse and worse and worse.
Milford residents were tired of the Amazon delivery vans flooding the town's crumbling roads every day. The trucks caused property damage. They caused havoc at a local cemetery. It has been a mess. This is the 411. I'm Corey Weinberg. On this week's show, I'll speak to our intrepid Amazon reporter, Paris Martineau, about what she found in Milford. She wrote a story this week about what happens when people, residents, and a whole town feel the physical negative effects of a tech giant's growth. Amazon has invested tens of billions of dollars toward expanding its in-house delivery network during the pandemic, with a particular focus on opening these kind of new delivery hubs. There will be more Milfords. Then, in the second part of the episode, I spoke with the Information's Hong Kong bureau chief, Shai Oster, about why investors are spooked after Chinese ride-hailing giant Didi Chuxing's IPO. All right, Paris, we have you back on the show to talk about another fascinating tale of Amazon logistics woes. And I remember talking to you about the story that you wrote, like, at first a few weeks ago when you told me you were in Milford, Massachusetts, reporting a story. You rented a car, drove there from New York. Why'd you go there? What is Milford?
Yeah, so Milford is a pretty unremarkable small town just southwest of Boston. It's about kind of a 45-minute drive from the metro area there. And I hadn't heard of it either until I kind of fell into reporting this story. As I was looking into kind of local news reports about run-ins with Amazon vehicles, I noticed that there had been a lot of issues this town had been experiencing with one Amazon warehouse in particular.
This was an Amazon warehouse that sprung up in, I think, 2016, your story says. What was the purpose of this warehouse? It wasn't like a big sprawling warehouse, right? It was much smaller.
Yeah. So it's this specific type of Amazon facility called a delivery station. And these are a lot smaller than the kind of gargantuan Amazon warehouses most people think of when you think of an Amazon warehouse. Those are called fulfillment centers, and those are the places where, you know, your order is kind of packed into a box. Delivery stations are the last stop in Amazon's kind of delivery operations. It is where eventually your package is taken, and then a bunch of delivery vans come to the station, pick up packages, tens of thousands of packages every day, and deliver them to customers' doorsteps within about a 45-mile radius.
Gotcha. So it's sort of this like choke point for Amazon deliveries for a specific area. Is that right?
Yeah. I like to think of them as like mini post offices, but just for Amazon. It's like this like central hub where all the packages kind of come into and go out of.
Where did things start to go wrong for Milford residents? What has life been like there?
These delivery stations are key to Amazon's expanding delivery operations. They are the last piece of that puzzle where Amazon now, as it wants to deliver more and more of its own goods, this allows them to do that. So when this facility came to town in Milford in 2016, it was relatively new. It was probably within the first 100, 150 delivery stations to open in America. And things started to go south pretty quickly. Milford residents hadn't really thought much about when an Amazon facility was opening up. It was kind of a footnote in local news. But within a year, residents started to notice the flood of hundreds of delivery vans coming in and out of the facility every hour. Upwards of 400 vans would take to the streets every morning and kind of storm through intersections in the small town,
All because they were delivering packages to other like neighbor, like these weren't just for Milford residents, right? These were vans delivering packages for all the neighboring towns, essentially.
This one facility in this small town served as the kind of last stop for all of Amazon's delivery operations in the Boston metro area, as well as wealthy suburbs in the surrounding areas. And so with Amazon delivery stations, they handle huge volumes of packages every day, tens of thousands of orders. And how they do that is they have these contractors that operate kind of little delivery van empires for Amazon. And 50 of these vans will come in and out of the facility every half hour, which adds up to a lot of traffic.
And are the issues just traffic? Like, you also described some kind of wackier things that sort of happened as a result of these trucks hitting the road.
Yeah. So traffic was just kind of the beginning. These vans, you know, would be moving through town in strange ways, kind of in a coordinated pack of 100 or so as they stormed intersections and whatnot. But they would also end up leaving behind a lot of trash and bottles of urine and parking three abreast on roadways so that no one could get through. It kind of made life a bit of a nightmare for surrounding residents. But the vans weren't the only issue, because the packages have to get to the delivery station, and those packages are brought there by tractor trailers. And those started to become an increasingly big problem in Milford. In the beginning, dozens of tractor trailers would kind of roll into town at weird hours of the night between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. And these vans would end up routed down like narrow streets or residential areas where a tractor trailer can't really fit. So a lot of property damage starts to happen, as well as if 12 tractor trailers are rumbling down your one-way residential street at 2 a.m., it's going to wake up everybody in the neighborhood, which residents didn't really like. And a lot of tension started to happen between local officials in Milford that wanted to know where all this was coming from, and Amazon, which for the first couple of years wasn't really responsive to officials whatsoever.
Yeah, like how did Amazon end up taking responsibility for some of this? How did they kind of manage these kind of difficult town relations that they were having?
So this all started in 2016, and Amazon didn't really start to play ball until late 2020. And that was also around the time when Amazon decided to open a second facility in Milford, a sortation center, which made the number of tractor trailers go from a couple dozen to in the hundreds every single day. And so one thing that my reporting on this uncovered, which I found really fascinating, and I wasn't kind of expecting going into this, is that in early 2020, Amazon launched a kind of new team within Amazon Logistics called Community Operations, which is specifically designed to, curb PR problems that may be happening as it relates to these sort of delivery stations.
Right. This is happening in towns across the country, I think you pointed out in your story.
Yeah. This is not just a Milford story. I mean, the number of towns that had delivery stations prior to 2019 was fairly low, but over the last year and a half, Amazon has opened nearly 300 of these facilities. So the number of communities that are experiencing these sort of problems is growing at a rapid pace, and Amazon is having to kind of scramble to keep up. So this new team that they formed, it came to Massachusetts and Milford specifically in October of 2020. And when that team arrived, finally there was some Amazon people at least showing up at city meetings to hear the complaints of residents and address concerns when, say, an Amazon tractor trailer accidentally drove into a cemetery and damaged monuments.
Wait, what happened? What happened at the cemetery?
A lot of things happened at the cemetery. This is another part of the story I was not expecting. The second Amazon facility that opened in Milford, the sortation center, it turns out it's located exactly across the street from one of from like the local cemetery, and tractor trailers have run into the fence outside the cemetery, hit, taken out a tree. One was directed by the GPS program they were using to drive into the cemetery, where they then hit a monument at the cemetery and two signs, which led Amazon, according to local officials, to have to offer their condolences to the family of the person whose grave was damaged.
That's not what you want if you're Amazon.
It's definitely not ideal, no.
So what, I guess I'm curious, the broader picture with this story. Like, I think you and I are both attracted to stories where you have these tech companies that are reshaping local life in ways that sneak up on residents. You know, we've both talked about Airbnb a lot before where this happens. But I feel like there's an interesting undercurrent here about more than just like NIMBYism, more than just like we don't like new things in our backyard. What are like the important issues that you think a story like this raises that we're just kind of at the tipping point at? Like, there are going to be more Milfords. Why should we care?
Yeah, I think that kind of speaks to the fact that a company like Amazon, that up until fairly recently has been predominantly thought of as, you know, an internet retailer or a digital tech behemoth of some sort, their operations and ambitions have grown to the size where now they're having a profoundly physical impact on towns across the U.S. and around the world, really. And I think that this story kind of illustrates the many challenges that Amazon's going to be facing in all of these different communities because of the pace of its physical expansion. Because Amazon has spent billions of dollars expanding this network, the delivery network, during the pandemic. And so it's going to have to find a way to play nice with all of these communities, or at least kind of find a way to respond to all of the crises that come up.
What happens next in Milford?
Well, in Milford, the most recent update within the town is since this Amazon community operations team has come and started partnering with local officials, Amazon has agreed to try and fix the property damage issues that come from all these tractor trailers accidentally going down the wrong streets. Amazon has agreed to design and pay for a bunch of fancy metal signs that say no Amazon trucks in English and Spanish and have a cute little cartoon of an Amazon tractor trailer with a big red X on it. And so they've been installing that all around the city with mixed results. But
right,
the program is apparently going to be offered to communities around the nation. So
wow,
probably something along that line.
I think I know what I'm getting you for your next birthday, Paris. That would be
that
truly, sign adorned on your walls would be a sight.
That'd it'd
be
fit awesome. Right in with the gallery wall, if we're being honest.
Right. Well, thanks so much for coming out to talk about your story. It was a fascinating one, as always. And I'm excited to see what you pursue next. What other small town will you go to? We'll have to see.
Yeah. Any listeners out there got an interesting small town Amazon story? Give me an excuse for a road trip.
Thanks, Paris.
Thanks, Corey.
When Chinese ride-hailing giant Didi Chuxing went public at the end of June, investors were pretty warm to the deal. Its stock rose on the first day of the IPO, giving it a market capitalization of $68 billion. Now, it's trading below that IPO price, and its business is somewhat in doubt. And what happened is a warning sign for Chinese companies going public in the U.S. I'm here with the Information's Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Shai Auster. Thanks for joining me, Shai.
Thanks for having me.
So you're calling in late night in Hong Kong. It's been a really busy couple weeks. If you are a Didi watcher and journalist and chronicler, as you are, let's talk about last week. Didi went public. Its first day, it went okay. Like, what was your sense of the initial kind of run up to the IPO?
So Didi had been, you're right, okay is the way to put it. You could argue it traded almost flat. The IPO valuation wasn't much higher than its last private round, but it went up a bit, right? And so, you know, it is arguably did okay, right? It had signs that it was going to turn a profit. It looked like it could continue growing. It was in China, which is the Chinese economy was doing pretty well, better than, you know, it had recovered faster from COVID than the rest of the world. And so I thought, okay, you know, even if you have doubts about the business model, this seems to be priced at a fairly attractive level.
And so a ho-hum sort of IPO story, but that all changed in recent days in which Chinese regulators forced Didi to withdraw its apps from app stores. Why were they forced to do that? What happened?
So this was a stunning and sudden move by the Chinese government on the grounds of cybersecurity. On Friday, actually, they'd said you have to stop registering new users. And then the following week on the Sunday night, they said you have to pull the app from the app store, citing serious violations of China's national cybersecurity laws, basically saying the app can't grow, right? So current existing users could continue to hail cabs, but the app wouldn't be able to grow anymore. And then they would be conducting a review of their processes. It was just kind of a real stunning blow and just confusing as to why it would happen a few days after the IPO, because you figure if the government's looking at it, why would they do it before the IPO? Because it's, you know, everyone's first thought was, wait a second, this smells a lot like what happened to Ant Financial, which is the online financial services giant owned by Alibaba's Jack Ma, and sort of the affiliate of Alibaba, which was that massive, was going to be one of the biggest IPOs ever.
Yeah, they had to scrap it.
Right, and it was scrapped ahead of time. So people thought like, well, wait a second, how come they, this seems almost vindictive in the way that it was punishing the investors in the company, right? Didi's, the IPO served its purpose. Didi raised $4 billion, right? But the investors are the ones who got dinged. So everyone was like, wait a second, what's going on?
Right. Do you have any sense whether Didi knew this increased government scrutiny was happening?
So
ahead of that's got to be a question a lot of people are asking.
Right, and there's already been some class action lawsuits filed. So yes, they knew. They knew that there was scrutiny, and they disclosed it, actually. They were very clear, and they disclosed this in their filings, that they had been one among many companies called in with meetings with regulators to discuss, you know, their stricter requirements now on data privacy and other issues. The thing that's kind of throwing everybody for a bigger loop on this one is the talk of national security. You know, if you look at the Chinese Twitter sphere, the Weibo sphere, there's all this talk about that somehow Didi, and it's actually not just them, there's two other companies, were also dinged on security grounds. And so Didi sits on important data, right? It has like maps. Maps in China are very sensitive, right? And it has the information of where everybody's going, which you could see being a national security issue. But that data is all housed in China, right? Like there's not, they're not going to like...
Right, on their servers.
Right, it's not on AWS, right? It's not sitting in Seattle or whatever, right? Like it's sitting on their servers in China. But somehow there's this problem now that, oh, well, is this somehow subject to U.S. jurisdiction? And then there's all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories on the Chinese web. And now, part of that is just like...
Well, what's the bigger picture
sure. Here?
Like, sitting here in the States, you see kind of this growing scrutiny from Chinese regulators onto some of their most valuable companies, mostly in the tech sphere, and you have the government clamping down on them. You know, these should be like the national pride of the country, right? Like why sort of this throttling of private business
sure,
in China?
Sure. So there's a couple of themes. One is, well, isn't this happening to Google and Facebook and Amazon in the US and in Europe? Right? There's a global trend to rein in the power of these giant tech giants, which have become sort of supranational powers, right? So that's, I think, one thing. That's not just China that's looking at,
right,
you know, reassessing the power that these companies have, right? And secondly, yes, they, you know, in China, there's only one ultimate authority. That's the Communist Party, and at the top of it sits President Xi Jinping. And these companies, I think, were so powerful in some aspects. You know, when you look at, like, Alibaba, in some ways, they have a better idea of what's going on in the Chinese economy than any official would, right? The flow that they see across these billions and billions of dollars of transactions gives them a real-time snapshot in a way that the government doesn't have, right? And then they have the data on, you know, hundreds of millions of people buying and selling and what they want to buy and sell in a country where, you know, there is a question, like it's absolute control, and it's absolutely controlled by the Communist Party, right? You know, on the other hand, like like these companies are important to, are seen as important to the success and growth of the Chinese economy and country and to its projection of power on the global stage.
So the government is not killing Didi's business.
No,
Didi has a strong future.
Look, they employ millions of drivers, or rather provide income for millions of drivers, right? It's a gig economy, so to speak. And taxi drivers in China, and I like the rest of the world, are a notoriously rowdy bunch, right? They are networked, right? They know how to organize.
Right.
And like the
they
last,
know how to organize.
Yeah, the last thing they need is social unrest. And like shutting Didi down is not, I don't think, is not an option. Curbing it, curtailing it, telling it like, no, you've got to play by our rules is fine. Now, I've had some, you know, the speculation is wild about what's going on. Like, I was talking to one senior investor who's a former government official, right? So he's in the thick of this. He was saying, oh, well, I could see this being delisted. And I was like, whoa, that's the nuclear
right.
bomb. Like, wouldn't that be terrible for all Chinese companies? And wouldn't, He said, look, do you think the Communist Party cares about Western investors? No, right? They've been through worse and watched that everyone's kicks and screams for a while. And then after, you know, 6 months or whatever time, everybody comes back to the table because China is a place you need to play.
Well, it's a fascinating story of global politics and capitalism. And thanks so much for tracking it. And thanks for chatting with me about it.
All right, take care.
That's our show. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you to Paris and to Shai for joining me on today's episode. And thank you to Kenan Kush for producing the 411. Have a great weekend, everybody.